We also discussed last time about what is more important in the web, precision versus recall, okay? And what was it? What was more important? If you had to give up on something, which would you rather give up on, precision or recall? Recall. But that's only in the web. It's not always. You know, in general, in information retrieval, they're completely sort of orthogonal things, okay? And the general way to actually combine them, as I said, is to do the precision recall curves. And, you know, one thing that we didn't mention last time is probably a little more detail as to how these things are generated. It's not particularly hard to understand, but they normally talk about these things called 11-point precision recall curves. And all that means is the x-axis, you put for the recall 0, 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, etc. up to 1.0. So there are 11 points. Okay. For each of those levels of recall, you find out what is the precision. That's all. That's all 11-point precision recall curve is. Okay. So for example, here is a nice thing to look at just to make sure that we understand everything. So suppose for some query, the following documents have been shown up as the answers. Okay, let's assume that the blue ones are the relevant ones. Blue ones are the relevant ones. Now, how do I know? I have an oracle who tells me this. Or maybe I showed these results to the user, and the user said, yeah, I like this, I like this, I like this, and so on. Okay, so suppose there are totally, you know, that there are only 10 relevant documents for this query. Only 10. No more, no less. Okay. So you know that if you give all 10 relevant documents, you got 100% recall. That's all. Okay. So then, of course, you can, given this sequence of documents being spewed forth one after other to the user, you can see, for example, how is the recall, I mean, how is the precision on recall changing? Okay. So in the very beginning, zero precision, zero recall, if you didn't say anything, in essence, you are highly precise. So you all, the precision recall curves always start at 0, 1, okay? Now, by the time you come here, by the time you come up to this point, right, you still have, let's look at the third document. So if you look at up to third document, that'll be an interesting part. If you stop here, you have seen three documents till now, okay? Two of them are relevant. So the recall would be 2 by 10 because there were 10 documents which are relevant. And the precision would be 2 by 3, 0.26. That's all. Okay? So you do this for every one of those points. And you have a precision recall curve. And you remember the discussion last time. If somebody else's precision recall curve is pretty much all the time below it, then that method is not as good. Okay? And if somebody else's precision recall curve kind of cuts it through, then you know that for lower precision, sorry, for suppose you have, let's say, some curve going like this, then for lower recalls, the first one is better. For higher recalls, the second one is better. Okay? And for web, obviously, you're mostly looking at lower recall values. Okay, so going back to the IR model again, so I want to basically talk a little bit about the usual models that they use. So we actually talked in the precision recall stuff there. We skipped over actually how the system decided these documents are the ones worth returning. So now we want to just actually see, given a query, what are the documents that I should return? Okay, that's the whole idea of information retrieval. What we'll do is essentially look at a couple of, first, a top-level view of how text retrieval works, okay? Again, this is not the way Google works. This is the way classic text retrieval works. And you would notice that a lot of this is common with what you'll ultimately see Google doing, and some of it isn't, okay? And this is, again, reinforces something that I said earlier, which is much of what we would be doing here would be taking a traditional discipline such as information retrieval, talk a little bit about it, and then talk about how it would change now that it's being used on the web. Okay? So right now we're talking about how information retrieval was being done before web. Okay? The problem is almost same. So normally what you wind up doing, you of course have some database of all the text documents. If you need some example in mind, think of LexisNexis system, which I mentioned in the first class. It's one of these information retrieval systems that are used by doctors, lawyers, et cetera, for retrieving relevant cases, okay, where the cases are all in text, okay. So you have some database of text documents, and these are being indexed, okay, and you have an indexing of what appears where. Basically, the query itself would be a set of keywords, okay, that's the way. Normally, in fact, one other thing that I should mention is in IR, query is seen also as a mini document. It's seen as a document, okay? So you have documents in your database, and the query itself is just a little document. Now, in the case of Google, it's a really, really little document, but in the case of traditional information retrieval, somebody might actually write down a bunch of things about what they're looking for. So it could be a paragraph long document. And what you're saying is, what does this paragraph long document remind you most of in your database? So even though I will say query and documents, queries are just mini documents, okay? So if you can understand how two documents are compared, then you understand how a query is compared to the document. Okay, so there is like a uniformity there. Okay, having said that, so you have basically a database, and there is some sort of an indexing which says, if you are looking for the following word, here are all the documents where this word appears. Okay, pretty much most systems which do text retrieval use inverted indices. How many of you don't know what an inverted index is? Okay, I'll show you an example, but we'll talk about it later. Not so much in that structure itself, it's not particularly hard to understand. But basically all it says is, for each word, this index tells you what are the documents in which this word appears. That's all. Okay? So that's very useful for doing the retrieval. So if I'm looking for document, I mean, if my query is word K, then I know by going to the index, without having to laboriously go through the entire database, I know by going through the index what are the documents where this query actually appears. In fact, inverted index does little more than that. It not only just mentions what documents it appears, it also appears, it also tells you the absolute position at which this particular word appears. Why would the position be useful? Can somebody, again, I think some of what I'm saying should not be all that hard to, you know, guess. What? No, yeah, so that's a good point. So when you retrieve the document, you need to explain to the user why did you retrieve the document. And you would like to, for example, take a few words around the word where, the place where this word actually is appearing, and say, you know, look, this is the reason I gave you this document. Google does that for you, right? I mean, it basically shows you a little snippet. These are called the snippets, okay? So the snippet, to generate the snippet, it's not enough to say, take it from me, the word appears. And it's a million line document, but if you go through it, it's appearing somewhere. You need to show where it is. That's a useful use. That's a good use. What other uses can there be? Yes?
Not sure if this is what you're getting at, but a lot of times users want to put in the query, it's not just bat, it's baseball bat. And if you just have the word bat in there, you have to go out to the actual document in order to filter out all of the ones that are actual mammals.
Okay. So probably some of you are trying to say the same thing, which is proximity is important, okay? So if I have a query word baseball, I mean, as long as I only have one word in my query, I don't need to know the position except for the text snippet. But most of the time, my query would have more than one word. And when I have more than one word, if, like, you know, there is, if the query is baseball bat, then a document where baseball appears in the beginning of the document, bat appears somewhere in the middle, versus another document where baseball bat, appears together many, many times. This is much more relevant than this. Okay, so it's useful to have the positional information because then you can answer proximity queries. Having said that, now I would much, I mean, you know that proximity queries, I mean, proximity is a useful thing to use in answering queries, but I would not probably get into it into too much detail as we go on, because the simplest model just ignores proximity. Okay, but we'll look at that. Anyway, so that's your inverted index. That's the kind of index they wind up generating. Yes, sir. What? It is inverted. You're going from words to documents. You go from document to word, and all good indices are inverted indices. In fact, I know an index is an inverted index, right? I mean, in every textbook, there is an index at the end. And that's telling you where are these words appearing in the various chapters. And the normal way of reading the textbook is not reading the index. You know, reading the index is the inverted way of reading the textbook. So anyway, so it's just obviously it's the inversion of what the document is. Okay. So then you do the indexing is there, right? And then once you have the query, in fact, before you do indexing, you'll notice that it's going into the text operations module. So it's not as if every word in the document is actually indexed. In fact, in the classical retrieval, the entire document is never indexed. How many of you have seen a library record for some book, and it would say keywords for the book? Keywords for the book. So somebody decided, even though this book is, you know, 10 million words large, the only important words to know about this book are 15 keywords that they have written down. Okay, so somehow the entire document is never indexed. It's only the keywords that are indexed. Now the keywords may have been there manually because somebody sat down and wrote down the keywords for the document, or they might be automatically extracted from the entire text and say, oh, these are the useful ones, not everything. Okay, so all I would like to say is here is the set of the entire set of words, entire bag of words from the document. Here is a subset that you'll actually index. Okay, and how you go from there to there is text operations. And the kinds of things you do in text operations, if in fact there are manual set of keywords, you just ignore the entire document, only remember the keywords, and just index those. Okay, if you don't have the manual keywords, or if you think the actual keywords that somebody put are too short, too few, and it's not enough, okay, then what you would do is you would try to keep those as well as some more of the actual document. Okay. Now, in doing that, you would wind up doing text operations. The kinds of operations you do, you'll see in a minute, are things like stemming, which are, if there are variations of the same word, you know, you would essentially convert it to its canonical form, like binarization. You just remember binarize. Okay. And then various tenses of the same word, you might decide to remember just one tense. Okay. Now, when I'm doing this, there are two arguments. One argument is that it looks like a good thing to do. It reduces the number of words to store, but it's not at all obvious whether it improves precision and recall. Okay. Can you imagine stemming? So here's an interesting thing to ask, and I'll ask you that again a couple of slides later. You just understood what stemming is, which is basically taking variations of a word and just remembering one canonical form. Suppose somebody is doing stemming, your friend is doing stemming and you're not doing stemming. How would your precision recall compare to your friend's precision recall? Assuming you do everything else the same, you do the exact same retrieval algorithm. All that is different is one of you does stemming, the other doesn't. Okay? Keep it in the back of your head. So then after this text operation, you also do a bunch of query operations. So in fact, one other thing about the text operation is this thing called noun phrase detection. So for example, baseball, bat. Before they get split into baseball here, bat here, you would like to say baseball, bat. It's like a thing by itself. Okay, it's a phrase. And it's like, even though they're two different words, it's really talking about one thing. Okay, a data structure. Okay, it's a one thing, computer architecture, one thing, keep it together. Okay, so that when somebody is looking for architecture per se, they may not be looking for computer architecture. And similarly, when they're looking for bat per se, they may not necessarily be looking for baseball bat. So you would like to take close by words which are supposed to make a single noun phrase and put it together as a keyword. So here's an interesting thing. The keywords don't even have to be single words. They can be phrases. And you should not be surprised, because if you look at the keywords for books in the library, they would have multiple words, key phrases really. They're all key phrases, not keywords. What's interesting, of course, is you might want to, stemming, you might want to do it automatically. You might also want to do noun phrase detection automatically. And we'll talk about approaches for doing this later on. Okay? One obvious thing, even without going into too much details, is if in your document, most of the time, data is appearing, it seems to appear with structures. Okay? Then maybe they go together. Okay, there is this idea called co-occurrence. Okay, when they are co-occurring, maybe they are connected, so you can make it into a phrase, even if you don't know that it's actually a real phrase. So that's one way you could do it. Again, remember, much of what we're doing here is, as I said previously, information retrieval is trying to solve a problem which requires truly natural language processing, but without doing natural language processing. Okay, so you don't expect miracles. I mean, if you don't understand the language, you can never really know what is a noun phrase and what are the useful noun phrases to keep. Okay. So then the other thing is the query operation. What that is saying is that sometimes your query, I said query is also a document, but the query is obviously a smaller document, a few keywords. Sometimes what you can do is you can do elaboration on the query. So you said data structures in your query. I might say, well, data structures seems to appear all the time with algorithms. So I'll assume that you asked data structures and algorithms. So I elaborated your query. I added a couple more things for your query. Okay, that's a query elaboration. And of course, things like stemming, etc., should also be done on the query. Whatever you do, that's why these operations are being done after the text operation. If your database is stemmed, it better be the case that your query is also stemmed. Otherwise, you won't find anything that you're looking for. Okay. So you do this query operation. There are other things like relevance feedback, which we'll talk about. This, in fact, these two, what we're doing is the used car salesperson deal. Okay, so first, you take what the user asked as just the beginning of your conversation with the user and try to actually sell them what you really want to sell. Okay, so you asked for data structures, but I really have a lot of good things on data structures and algorithms, so I elaborate it with algorithms. Okay, the other thing is you've been clicking. You said data, right? And I showed you a couple of documents, and then you seem to be clicking on, a particular set of documents, for example, which have data structures next to each other. Okay, so can I learn from the few documents you have already shown interest in as to what your real query is? Now, this makes sense because, again, fundamentally, this guy has no clue how to convert this cloud into a query. We assume that the users don't know what they are really looking for. They know in their head, but their keywords is only a sort of a vague projection of what they're truly looking for. So in some sense, you have to keep adding more to the query to approximate what the user might actually be looking for. And that's why this idea of relevance feedback. So sometimes, in fact, I say data, but then the search engine shows a bunch of documents, and the user keeps clicking all the documents which has Britney Spears listed in it. Then you know that actually the guy really wanted documents about Britney Spears. Forget about data. So you remove data completely from consideration and give him 100 more documents on Britney Spears. All you care is happy user. Okay, he just didn't want to say the word Britney Spears because, friends were looking over the shoulder and he didn't want to be seen as a dweeb. Okay, so that's basically what we're talking about. Relevance feedback is, really, you said something, but do what I'm really interested in, not do what I said I'm interested in. What I said I'm interested in is just a footprint. Okay, so we'll talk about relevance feedback and how to do that a little too. And then after you do this, you have the query, and then you have the index, of course. So you compare the query terms to the terms in the documents, and that's basically the searching. So you look, basically you look for all the list of documents which have these terms at least in it, and if you are interested in proximity, those terms also appear close to each other. So now you'll get a set of documents at this point. These are all your possible answers. These are all your possible answers. So next thing you need to do is to rank them. Okay? And so the very big thing, of course, is going from here to converting this, which is just a list of all the documents which have all the words that you're looking for, into a ranked list of documents, where some are given in the first 10 and the next are given in the next 10, etc. And remember that one of the neatest things in information retrieval is, in fact, the whole reason that relevance feedback works in some sense is you don't show your entire set of cards. You don't put your cards on the table at the same time, all at once. You just show the top 10 first, let's say, and a top 100, a top 50, whatever. And based on the user's interest, you can actually change the second 10. So the first 10 that I showed in answer to that query data actually had mostly data-oriented, whatever data-oriented documents are, and two Britney Spears documents. And this guy clicks on the two Britney Spears documents, the next 10 magically don't have any data documents, all Britney Spears documents. Okay? Because you can act as if I always knew what you were really looking for. And that's the basic idea. You show top 10, the next 10, next 10, next 10. Okay? So the ranking is basically showing what you think currently are your top 10, and then based on the relevance, you can change it again. Okay, that's the usual text retrieval. Now, having said this, you can ask yourself how much of this stuff actually happens in your favorite search engine and how much doesn't. Okay, that's something that you can already start thinking, and then we will answer those as we go on. Questions? Okay. So let me go into more detail for today's class, really, about two pieces. The ranking part and the text operations part. Okay? Ranking, to some extent, is the heart of information retrieval. And the way you rank documents with respect to query depends on your model of what you think document is made of. Okay? And depending on that, the ranking changes. So we'll spend a lot of time on the ranking. Things like vector space ranking, all that stuff fall in the ranking. The query operation, the text operation, I want to say a little more about stemming and so on. Okay? And then the other things like query operations, that will come as a third topic. Basically, relevance feedback will come as a third topic. Okay. And then somewhere later down the line, we'll talk about indexing, which is sort of obvious. It's like 310 data structure stuff. Okay. You have an inverted index. How to quickly pick the documents? How should you organize your index such that you can pick the documents that have the keywords that you actually are looking for quickly? That's all. Okay. I mean, algorithms are important. If you are writing an square algorithm, you know, you're dead already. Okay, it's just that this is a different type of thing. The good algorithms for indexing and retrieval are important anyway. What's new here in information retrieval, as against databases, let's say, is this ranking and these kinds of text operations. Okay, so this is just basically the way index terms are generated. Okay, so the assumption is that you start from the documents and you basically do some operations until you are left with a set of terms that you think are the only terms that this document should be indexed with. Okay, not all that stuff. Okay, so the obvious things that you can do are stop word elimination. These are basically things like the, which nobody wants to actually, hopefully. Nobody would be looking for a document that has the word the, and unless they want the entire copy of the database. Okay, so you can remove highly frequent words which have really no meaning. Now, what's interesting is stop word elimination depends on the corpus to some extent. If you are looking at, all I know is that my database has documents written in English, the is a stop word. If I know that my database is basically a bunch of Chinese documents where a couple of times people would write English words in the middle, okay, that may not be a particularly good stop word. I might well be interested in those guys who are not purely speaking in Chinese and are adulterating the language with English in between. So I might actually ask for queries, you know, saying, give me all the, you know, the documents which have the word "the" in it. That's a good way of finding out who is not using Chinese and also throwing in English. Okay. If you have all the documents in your document are about information technology, computer would be a stop word. Web is a stop word. Web is not a stop word for anybody in the world before 1998, right? But web now is a stop word. If you actually ask Google to look for something saying World Wide Web, the craziest thing is the top conference where research about World Wide Web appears is World Wide Web Conference. Try to look for the URL for World Wide Web by saying World Wide Web Conference. And it says, well, world is too obvious, web is too obvious, so you have nothing left. Do you see what I'm saying? So in fact, it turns out that the only way you can search using Google for World Wide Web conferences are to do things like www10. That would be the 10th World Wide Web Conference. You can find it. Okay? But here's the interesting point, which is you would never have thought World Wide Web is a stop word. Nothing that you learned in English made you think that World Wide Web is a stop word. But it is, because if everybody has it, it's a stop word. Okay? Basically, stop words are too frequent, and so the useful queries, most useful queries are not likely to use those words as part of the query. That's the question. Noun phrase detection, I already told you, data structure, computer architecture, etc. Now, stop word elimination, as I described the way stop word elimination works, you already know how to do it automatically, do you? After you computed the inverted index, right, basically the first thing you would have done is you would have computed the index of the document, and if your index says, that, let's say, something like, it would say the number of documents it appears in, 3 billion gazillion, and then it gives all the places where it appears in. Okay. Actually, in fact, I'm jumping ahead. In a way, you don't actually compute the index until you decide the index terms. But in essence, what we are saying is if the word is appearing in most of the documents, then it's a useless word, so you remove it. Okay. So you know how to do the stop word elimination, basically remove the words that appear in most documents. The other is noun phrase detection. I haven't told you, I kind of said something about what you might want to do to get the noun phrase detection, do co-occurrence analysis. So words that appear together might be forming noun phrases. It's a harder thing to do. I'll get to it later. Yes?
For stop word elimination, is it important how often a word appears in a single document?
It's a very, very good question. The answer, it turns out, is it's much more important. The way stop words are determined is that it appears in all the documents, at least once. That's more important than it appears in one document lots and lots of times. Suppose if, in fact, one document is just A, the word A, okay, the word the, and that's the only document where that word appears, then it's actually a very useful document. It's a very useful word to know. Okay? It's a very good point. So, in fact, what you just said brings up two different issues. Again, jumping ahead to something that I'll be saying towards the end of the class. If you look at the number of words and the way they are distributed in documents, you can talk about the distribution of a word within a given document. That's called the term frequency. Basically, how often is the term appearing in that document? Okay? Term frequency. So if I have, my query is baseball bat, and I have a million word document where baseball bat, assume baseball bat is one single word, okay? Yeah, I have a million word document where there's one mention of baseball bat, another document where there are 10,000 mentions of baseball bat. I think all of you would agree that this one is somehow more relevant than this one. Okay, because yes, the word appears in both, but it appears way more times in the document, so this must be really talking about baseball bat. Now, of course, what's interesting is you know how to defeat this system, right? It could well be that this thing is about how to make baseball bats, and they just said once the baseball bat, and they talked about how to make it, and this is just a friend of yours who knew that you have this crazy thing about baseball bat, and so they put baseball bat, baseball bat, baseball bat, baseball bat, million times. Now, this wasn't a problem in the good old days when people who use retrieval systems were honest citizens or dweebs, you know, who don't have practical jokes in their mind. Okay? So the medical papers were written by medical doctors, and they wouldn't just put, you know, only baseball, I mean, only a particular word many, many times just to increase its citation. They do a little, but not anywhere near only that word and nothing else. All of us use buzzwords when we write things. Okay? It's just that if the only thing is buzzword, then, you know, people wouldn't have actually published it to begin with. But now we use the same kinds of techniques for web. So obviously, you know, I mean, many of you know that, I'm not telling you anything new, I hope, that a good thing to do to increase the retrieval value, for a while at least in the beginning of the web, of your page is, irrespective of what it is about, even if it's about 494, have a gazillion copies of the word sex in it. Somehow more people will see it. Okay? And if I should not show it to you, there are multiple ways in which I can write it. I can write the word sex in white back, you know, white font on white background, so that none of you can see it, but the machines can see it. So anybody looking for the most important query on the web would get my page as part of the answer. Okay? So this is about the frequency of a word in your document. And you know, if you're doing it by computer, why write it three times? I mean, you know, moderation is for monks, right? I mean, so you really want to do it large number of times, like 10,000 times. So more people are likely to look at it. The other, of course, is the way this particular word is distributed over documents. Okay? So there you're only asking how many documents in your corpus have even one mention of this word. Okay? So that's essentially the document frequency. That's essentially the document frequency. Okay? Now, it turns out that the higher the term frequency of the term you're looking for in a particular document, the more relevant that document is to some extent. Okay? And similarly, this is a non-trivial thing which is supposed to be towards the end of today's class, but why not? The higher the document frequency of a word in your query words list, so I have three query words, Q1, Q2, Q3. Okay? It turns out that Q1 has very high document frequency. That means every document actually has it. Q2, 90% of the documents have the word Q2 in it. Q3, only 10% of the documents have the word Q3 in it. Which are the important query words? Q3 is the most important, Q2 is the second most, Q1 is the least. Now, when I'm talking about stop word elimination, I'm actually talking about the extreme. I'm going to remove Q1 from consideration to begin with. But in essence, you can actually see that stop word elimination is the extreme of a general idea which takes document frequency of a word into account. That's all. And all we are saying is the importance of a word is sort of inversely proportional to its document frequency. And so this whole idea called inverse document frequency, IDF. We just mentioned two of the most important ideas in retrieval, which is term frequency and inverse document frequency. And basically the way you would decide how important different words are is to take TF, combine it with IDF. Okay. But that basically comes from this idea of stop words, which you can easily understand. Okay. Then stemming. To do the stemming, all you do is essentially, it's of course language dependent. You just take various forms of the word and, you know, standardize it to some obvious form, some canonical form. Okay. Now to do stemming correctly, you need to know something about the language. Okay. Binarization, you better not stem it to binarizate, B-I-N-A-R-I-Z-A-T. That would not be a good stemming. It better be the case that after you stemmed, the word still is a word, you know. So somebody needs to understand English, better not be me, and write down a bunch of rules which tells you how to stem the words in English. Tons of people, and only a couple of people have to do this. Not, you know, you don't have to redo this whole thing again. It's just obvious for each language, okay. So if you want to do your main contribution for information retrieval is going to be in stemming, pick a language that hasn't yet been stemmed, maybe Swahili or something. You know, English has been stemmed. Okay. So English, the most popular stemmer is Porter Stemmer, the guy called Porter, who basically wrote a bunch of rules which seem to capture the most obvious ways of stemming words, including rules like this. If suffix of a word is isation, and prefix contains at least one vowel followed by a consonant, clearly I couldn't have come up with this, then replace the suffix with I-Z-E. This is a rule. And this kind of rule would dawn on you if you have nothing else to do other than keep looking at English for long enough time, and you realize, in fact, there is method to the madness of English spelling. So Porter already did it. So everybody just copies over Porter's stammer and uses it, mostly, nothing else. Okay? Unless you have a lot of technical jargon whose stemming is slightly different from normal English word stemming, you just use Porter's stammer, that's it. Nothing new about it. It's worth understanding what stammer is, but it's done. There's no research here. After you do this, you gotten rid of some terms here, you kind of combine some terms into new terms, and then you also kind of collapse some terms into canonical form. So only some number of terms in the original document are left. Now from them you generate the index terms. You can either look at all of them as the index terms, or look at some of them as the index terms. Normally, what happens is people actually look at the terms here and then manually say these are the index terms in the traditional information retrieval. What do search engines do, you think? At this point, they say everything left over is an index term. That's what they do. In fact, it might be interesting for you to go and check, and unless you already checked, and I know that a lot of you are already staring intently at laptops, what does Google do in terms of stemming? Does it do stemming or not do stemming? What? They don't do stemming. They don't do stemming because they have large enough, one of the interesting things that you would see is text retrieval as a field existed when the largest computer actually, subscribed to Bill Gates' view of what is the largest computer, who said, many of you know that Bill Gates said, nobody would need to have more than 640K memory. This is a guy who actually is writing larger and larger programs that you need like tertiary devices to just put the program on. But back in like 1992 or something, he said, yeah, nobody really would need anything more than 640K as memory. When he meant, he actually probably disk too, because these are the floppy disk era where you'd put the operating system, etc., on the disk itself. So the important thing to understand is much of this work, the original text retrieval work, as in fact is the case with much of computer science, was done when computing power is pretty darn scarce. Okay? And now we are coming to a scenario where computing power is not that scarce at all. So what Google does is it basically puts everything as an index term. It does remove stop words. So the only thing that you would want to do if you have given infinite amount of computing power and the space, then the only reason you want to do any of these is if they would improve your precision and recall, not to just make your life simpler. In the past, there are two different mixed motives for doing this. Part of them to improve the precision and recall, part of them because I have this, 2 hertz machine with 3 bytes of memory, and how do I do, stuff with it. And the stuff with it is you do most of the problem yourself and then give the answer to the computer so that it will print it back in nicer font. Okay? So the point again is these are useful stuff, but in a way, Google basically has a large enough database and it doesn't feel the need to stem. So how do you figure out whether Google does stemming or not? By the way, when I use the word Google, you can use any other word, any other search engine. How would you figure out? Exactly. You don't need to call Serge Ibrin to figure this out. All you do is write stemming as a query, see the top 10 results, write stem as a query, see the top 10 results. If they're different, then it's using, I mean, it's not using stemming. If they're the same, then it is using stemming. Right? Okay, you can sometimes, even if you, without lobotomizing, you can figure out certain things. And, you know, that's important. The other interesting thing is, do you think the number of times a word is present in the query, does that matter to Google? Check. You'd be surprised. Okay, so, you know, say just bat once, and then say bat, 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 bat. Of course, you can only say it 10 times. Because Google actually now has a upper bound as to the number of keywords that you can put in the search. How many of you actually think what I just said is really shows how far a web search is from information retrieval? Google officially has a limit on the number of keywords you can put in the query. It does. If you put the entire thing, it just kills the top, you know, after the top 15 or top 10, and the first 10 words, and then just uses, the rest is out. So basically, Google has realized nobody is doing information retrieval anyway. Okay? These are not doctors looking for papers that are similar to the carefully constructed list of symptoms that their patient has. People are just looking for your 2.5 word queries. And so if people are looking for 2.5 word queries, take 3 sigmas away from it and then stop saying, I would not look for more than 10 words because nobody else is looking anyway. And so, in fact, that became part of the definition of the problem now. Nobody uses large number of keywords. Okay, so that's another interesting way in which web search is different from text retrieval. In web search, the assumption that query is a document, however small, is becoming less and less reasonable assumption. Because in fact, it's not a document at all, it's just a bunch of 10 words, that's it. The way Google at least does it, okay? So that's the thing about, the two things that I said about what Google does in terms of stemming as well as repeated words. Then, so you do the index terms here, most search engines just use all the terms as index terms here. And then improving the quality of the terms, that's essentially things like co-occurrence, computation and so on, and we won't talk too much about it right now. We might come back to it later. Most known search engines, current day search engines, don't do this at all. Okay. One of the things I hope you'd realize is, as I said earlier, the current day search engines are meant for everybody. Okay. The common needs of everybody are very different from common needs of some subset of people. Okay. So when you start having search engines tailored to certain types of areas, let's say, these are called the vertical search engines. Okay? When you are making a search engine for biologists or making a search engine for computer scientists, okay, then all this stuff that you learned today would be useful again. Okay? But if you're doing the search engine for everybody in the world, then, and remember that if all the scientists in the world hated Google, it can still be the top search engine in the world. Why? Because the number of scientists in the world is too small. All that matters is the guy who's looking for Britney Spears got all the Britney Spears links that he or she wanted. Okay? And then they'll all vote, yes, 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 Google is the best. And then the scientists are saying, no, 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 and they write papers nobody reads, and you know how it goes. Okay, so it's different based on how big your population is. You know, it's when you're going to worry about these things. And in fact, about the only thing that's left in the search engines arena is vertical search engines. We'll understand how these big search engines work, but really the neat stuff that's all left out there is topic-specific search engines. That is not done well at all. Okay, I know, so the rest of these slides, I'll try to go faster and see, stop me if I'm going too fast. So this is examples of stemming and top word elimination. So if you have a text like that, you know, those would go away as top words, for example. And that estimated, if you use the right words, obviously I already kind of screwed up because if I remove ED, then it will become estimate, which is not even a word. So I'm sure Porter would have said, if you have ED, then remove the D and keep the E. when the number of continents preceding you is 3 divided by 4 or some such thing. And, you know, that's the correct rule. And you use that, you would get estimate, believe me. Okay. So that's your stammer for that particular piece of information. Okay. And then we talked about all these other things already. Does Google use stemming? Does it use all kinds of stemming? Does it use stop word elimination? Any non-obvious stop words? For example, web is a non-obvious stop word. It has nothing to do with English language. It's just something that every web page seems to have the word web. Okay. Okay, ranking. That's the interesting part. So ranking is basically ordering. And you're trying to order it in such a way that you would, the ranking would be optimal with respect to the user's relevance metric, which thankfully you don't know anything about. So you're trying to essentially optimize with respect to something that's not known. Okay, that's what most interesting problems in the world are like that. You know, when you're trying to do well in your job, you're trying to optimize with respect to what your boss thinks you should be doing as against what your boss says you should be doing. Okay, if you just do what your boss says, you may still not be promoted well. Okay, so we all are looking for implicit metrics. And in this course, we'll at least see here, of course, the entire relevance for search engines is in the head of the user. And when we start talking about things like clusters, that too is in the head of user. We don't even know what an optimal clustering would be. And what we'd be doing is trying to see what would this do, what would this do. Okay. Anyway, so there are various types of ranking methods. The kinds of things that you want to take into account in doing ranking is whether the document will have sets of index terms that are common, okay? Whether the weights of these terms are sort of in sync with the weights of those terms in the key, in the query. So if the query said bat, 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 and my term frequency of bat in my document is very small, that means it only appears once in about a million words, then maybe it's not particularly relevant, okay? And the third is likelihood of relevance. Now, this is how, you know, when you don't know what you're doing, it's always nice to write three things, right? First two things kind of can be computed, third thing is actually first two things plus a lot more. You know, my classic example is when I was in grade school, they were explaining how to understand sound, okay, sound. And they said, sound has three properties, okay? Pitch, intensity, quality, right? Right? All of you heard this. Now, what's wrong with that? Quality is the thing that I have no clue, in fact, how to measure. You know, I know I can make Britney Spears sound at the same pitch and intensity as Paul McCartney, and yet I would have very different appreciation of the two pieces of music. And that has to be because of quality. And I have no way of measuring quality. So I throw everything else plus more into the last thing, and that's exactly what we did here. Common sets of index terms, sharing of weighted terms, and likelihood of relevance. Really what I should do is likelihood of relevance, which I hope maybe is connected to this, maybe is connected to this, and maybe is connected to other things. Okay, all I want to do is actually find out likelihood of relevance, which I don't know how to do. Okay, and we'll see different people, I mean different models wind up defining likelihood of relevance in different ways. Here is a nice big diagram, which I won't go into all of it, as to how many different models are there about text retrieval. Okay. So for example, at the classic models, you have Boolean, vector, and probabilistic. We'll look at least Boolean and vector. Vector is what most of the people use, okay? The structured models, they will start taking into account things like proximity of the keywords. So if you say baseball and bat, there are two files in which, one in which baseball and bat appear together all the time, the other they don't, you would give higher weightage to the one which are closer, okay? The issue of one other thing that you could do to improve relevance, it turns out, is to start, especially if you're talking about document-document similarity, is to make your comparison at large pieces of text level rather than at the word level. Okay, if you think in terms of words, you know, if I were to use word-based similarity for the term papers that people give me to decide whether or not they're plagiarizing each other's term papers, I would think most of you are plagiarizing because, you know, most students tend to have poor vocabularies. They wind up using the same 2,000 words. And so, in fact, all of you are using the same words. But they are actually being arranged very differently. And so all I need to actually do to talk about plagiarism is piece of text here, and compare them. That's much harder. Okay. So here's the problem that I'm just bringing up, which is sort of connected to, but not exactly the same as, what is involved in retrieving query-relevant documents. Query-relevant document essentially says, if you think of query as a document, other documents as documents, find the document that's most similar to this query document, right? If I'm into that, I should also be able to answer the question, here is a student's paper, and I'm worried that this guy might have copied. Show me all the papers in this large corpus of all the papers that people ever submitted to me. Which of the papers are likely to have been the ones from which the student plagiarized from? Okay? That's basically plagiarism detection. That's an actual technical problem, basically duplicate detection on the web. Okay? It turns out you can't do it at the word level. You have to do it at larger than word level. Normally what they do is they do at shingles level. A shingle is a bunch of text. Okay? People don't actually, so there's one extreme is word level. The other extreme is lazy level, where the poor guy just copied the entire paper and submitted, so it's identical. But most people are neither word level nor other level. What they do is they take big pieces of paragraph and put some of their junk in it, and then put some other big pieces of paragraph from another paper. Right? That's what you do. I mean, you know, we are smart. I mean, we're not totally dumb. It's just we're lazy when we're writing these things. Right? So what you do then is you have to compare shingles. So the shingles are being rearranged. There's a shingle here, the shingle here, they're the same. Okay? And there are many more shingles than there are words. Right? And in fact, shingle-based document-document comparison is the way you do duplicate detection. As much, it's quite a different problem in terms of actual computational machinery. Okay? But you could use some ideas from that to improve the retrieval with respect to your query, if in fact your queries are large enough. Okay. Okay. So there are all those different models, and all I'm going to talk about is a couple of them. One is the Boolean model. The other is the vector model. Boolean model, as the name implies, essentially assumes the document is a bag, is a set of words. It's a set of words. So each word is a propositional feature. It's there or not, it's there or it's not there. Okay? So each document is a what? If you think of each word as a propositional feature, then each document is a big old conjunction. Okay, so word one, word two, word three, etc., word million. So document D7 is word one and word four and word nine and word 15. That's the document. And some other one would be another conjunction. So all documents are conjunctive formulae. Okay, we're talking about sets. Sets are connected to Boolean algebra. Boolean algebra is connected to propositional logic. Right? Yes? Okay. So basically what we're saying is each document is a conjunctive propositional formula. What's a query then? If the query is also a conjunctive propositional formula, it's very easy to check. All you need to see is if this little conjunction is present in this big conjunction. If so, then this document is an answer. If not, it isn't. Okay? Now, you can actually be, if you are into propositional logic mode, it's not required that the queries have to be conjunction. Queries can be arbitrary formulas. Suppose I could say, give me all the documents which have W1, and whenever they have W3, they also have either W4 or W5. Have I made your head spin? I mean, I know that you never look for this kind of stuff on Google, but you might want to. I mean, you just reduce your expectations as to what can be done that you never think of these kinds of queries. But this is a normal query. It's a reasonable query. Give me all the documents which have the word W1, and whenever it has W2, it either has W4 or W5. So W1 and W2 implies W4 or W5. That's a Boolean formula. So what do I do when I have such a Boolean formula? I can do propositional entailment. Okay? and see whether or not this formula is satisfied. In fact, all you need to do is check if this formula is satisfied by this document. And each document, in a sense, is defining the exact word, saying these words are true, these words are false. And so you can compute the truth value of this arbitrary propositional formula in the context of this document. And if it is true, then the document is an answer. If it's not, then the document is not an answer. Simple. Okay? Now, you could also think of it as a general case of the more specialized case that we've been thinking of, which is any random query of this form can be always converted into what's called a DNF, disjunctive normal form. Okay? Where it's basically a disjunction of conjunctions. So any arbitrary Boolean formula can be converted into a disjunction of conjunctions. So then what I need to do is, if I know how to do the conjunctive formula retrieval, which is very obvious, right? A conjunctive formula is, if I look for A and B and C, then any conjunction which has A and B and C, as long as it has those, it's answer. So now, any random formula, I wind up converting it into these, in essence, components, which are all conjunctive components. And if the document contains any one of those components, then I'm in. If not, I'm not. Okay? Now, this is Boolean model. One interesting thing about Boolean model, and I'm not actually going into how to do this, because you know how to do this. This is all Boolean logic, right? I mean, you know how to convert any arbitrary formula into DNF, and how to compare a small conjunction to a big conjunction. And of course, you might want to do it more efficiently and that stuff, but you know, this is the basic idea. Now, what are the advantages and disadvantages of Boolean model? This, unfortunately, says drawbacks, but before going to the drawbacks, let me remind you that you were surprised, at least some of you were surprised, that one can even think of queries such as W1 should be there, and when W2 is there, either W4 or W5 should be there. That seems like a pretty darn complex query. You can't ask Google for this query. Okay? Right? Can you, for example, ask Google for the query that a document has W1 but not W2? See, some of you don't even know that because you never even considered asking such queries. Look at how little it takes to make us happy. I mean, you know, it seems to me that these are reasonable queries, but we won't ask them. It turns out Google, you can allow negation. If you want to say, give me document which has W1 but not W2, say W1 minus W2. If you put a minus, then it basically looks for documents which don't have that word, as against documents which have that word. Now, it turns out the way Google does it is it basically does it as a little add-on on top of normal vector space modeling, which we'll get to in a minute. Okay? It does not have the ability to do the kind of thing I'm talking about, which is a complex Boolean formula. I can say it's not there, but I'd say whenever it's not there, it better be the case that either this other thing is there or some other thing is there. Wow, that's got hard. Okay, this was the first model that you know people looked at in text retrieval, and most library information systems actually allow these, believe it or not. They are under the advanced search part. In fact, I would take back this thing about Google. I might be wrong in the sense, but Google does have this thing called advanced search, which nobody probably ever clicked. Okay, it does allow slightly more advanced features, but I still don't think it allows full disjunction and implication, etc. It does allow negation in the front itself. Okay, but you might look at it. Okay, so there are some plus points for, you know, given that you already know how keyword search works, Boolean search is slightly more interesting looking. What's negative about this is, in some sense, it's like all or nothing. If you have a set-based model and you're using Boolean logic as the underlying substrate, Boolean logic is a two-valued logic, true or false, relevant or not relevant. So either the document is relevant or it's not relevant. So you have a bunch of documents with one as the score, and the rest are all zero as the score. And how do you rank a bunch of ones? No obvious ranking measure. Okay, that looks like a bad thing. The other thing is this. Information need has to be translated into a Boolean formula which most users, and by that they mean the dweebs, lots, you know, the entire world sweeps who use the search engines who find it particularly hard to do. Okay, now this almost makes you feel as if the users have easier way of translating what they want into keywords. We know that's not the case either. It's just that at least they won't feel pained in writing the keywords. They're just far away from what they're looking for anyway. It's like, you know, what they're saying, this, you know, teaching a pig to sing, it doesn't work and it annoys the pig. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to tell random people how to express what they have in their head, okay? It's actually clearly the case that writing it into proper Boolean logical formulas is closer probably to what they might be looking for than a bunch of keywords. But it doesn't work because they don't know the Boolean logic, and it annoys them because they don't know the Boolean logic. Okay, so nobody uses it. So you say, forget it, just use a bunch of keywords and, you know, let's see how far we can go. That's basically what, you know, it's nice to understand, you know, this so-called drawback. It's drawback because nobody really knows how to do this. I mean, normal users don't know how to do this. And as you know, user is always right. So, you know, even though I get to call them names in this class, you know, you cannot really call them names and try to sell them software. It's pretty hard. So then the other thing, of course, this is connected to this. The Boolean queries that the users do actually formulate are pretty simplistic. So they're mostly, you know, conjunctions are maybe conjunction with a couple of negations. That's it. Okay, so why even bother with the molecules thing? Now the bigger problem, of course, is the ranking. And what I want to show you before you leave is to say that, in fact, ranking can be done easily enough without giving up too much. Okay, all you need to do is, rather than think of documents as sets, think of documents as bags. By the way, this is the biggest change. After you convert from sets to bags, vector space is just a little variation on the bag model. Okay, so previously, think about this. Previously, suppose you have a bunch of documents. These are really short documents, each of them. So this one would be system and human and system and, so there are two systems. So system and engineering and testing and EPS. That's it. Assuming and goes away because of the stop word. That's the Boolean representation of that. But as a bag, really it has two systems in it, not just one system. As a set, how many other copies of the word system you have, it's just a system. Okay? If you're a bag, then the difference between bags and sets is, in bags you care about copies of the same element. That's all. So if I think in terms of bags, then in essence what I would do is basically, in this particular case, two copies of word system and in document A. In the document A, this is the column that it has, it basically says it has two copies of the word system and one copy of the word human, one copy of the word EPS. That's the bag for document A. Now if I have document, if I have bags like that, and here is another example, these are, you know, it turns out that this is an example we'll keep using several times. Here are 10 documents. It so happens that the top five, these are the terms, T1, T2, etc., okay, up to T6. It turns out that the top five documents are basically about databases. And the last five documents are basically about statistics. They have a common word, data. The word data appears in database books as well as statistics books. Okay? So it turns out that these are statistical documents, these are database documents. You understand this part, right? So now, here are the way they are defined. Document D1 has 24 words, 24 copies of the word database, and 21 copies of the word SQL, 9 copies of the word index, and so on. Okay? Now, all I need to tell you to do bag-based retrieval is to tell you how to compare two documents. If I can compare two documents, I can also compare query and a document, because query is just a document. So all you do for that is this idea called Jaccard similarity, which is actually a generalization. It's also defined for sets. So if you want to talk about how similar two sets are, one way you can do it is you take the cardinality of the intersection and divide it by the cardinality of the union. And if the two sets are exactly the same, that would be 1. If they are completely disjoint, it will be 0. If they have more and more overlap, it will be between 1 and 0, with the number becoming towards 1 if it's higher overlap. So that's the usual metric of comparing similarity between sets. And all you want to do is to just change this for bag semantics. And the way bag semantics is done is, intersection is defined as the min operation. So if suppose I have 5 apples, so I think here, so A has 5 oranges and 8 apples, B has 3 oranges and 12 apples, these are 2 bags. Sets wise, it's apples and oranges, these are also apples and oranges, so they're exactly equal. But these are completely different bags, okay? Now the intersection of B, A intersection B, is 3 oranges and 8 apples, because those are the minimum oranges and minimum apples. Okay, and then the union is essentially the max. Okay, and then you add up the elements. So, you know, when you add up the elements, it's oranges plus apples would be the total number of fruits. Simple idea. Okay, so the Jaccard similarity between A and B is 11 by 17. And for our example, suppose I want to do similarity between D1 and D2. And D1 is a bag, D2 is a bag, and I computed the similarity using the same idea. I'll be 0.3644. And so if you give me a query, and one of the nice things that comes out of the box is I can actually give a query which is database, SQL, 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 linear. That would be different from database, SQL, linear, because the bags are different for the query. Okay. Now the last question I want to ask you is the following, before you leave, which is, what is the similarity between the document D1 and a document D1, which is just D1 concatenated with D1? Do you understand? I mean, I can make those documents, right? I mean, I like my paper so much, I copied it twice and write a larger paper now. So the question is, how similar is my new paper to the old paper? How similar do you think is my new paper to the old paper? 1, what does bag similarity metric tell me? Half. So I can keep increasing the size of my paper and the bag would be telling me that, my God, your newer paper is actually so different from your old paper. You know, and so I keep writing more of this. The point I'm trying to make is, as nice as this result seems to be, you better normalize. Because the relevance of a document better not have anything to do with how big it is. Unless you think somehow big documents are more relevant, the relevance of a document has to be about the distribution of the words in the document rather than how big it is in terms of bytes. So one important issue in ranking metrics such as Jaccard similarity is it better be the case that D1 and D1D1 are equally similar to each other, basically have similarity 1.0. In particular, more importantly, if the query Q better be similar to D1 just as much as it is similar to D1D1. If they are too equal, then they are both equally similar to a third party. Okay? In retrieval, this is very important, and you wind up normalizing it. And one way you can normalize it, in fact, is actually to normalize the bags such that all the size of the bag somehow is normalized, and the fractions, so then all the weights become fractions. Okay? In fact, you can do it, this normalization, any number of ways. One is you can actually take the absolute size of the bag, okay, and the modulo of apples plus oranges, and the modulus of apples plus oranges, and that will be a number, and just divide it by divide the original bag representation by this number, such that everybody's coefficients are normalized back to normalized back such that all of their bag representation would be exactly size 1. So another way of doing the same thing is to take Euclidean. So you can think of, until now I talked about bags, right? The only thing I'll do when I come back next class is I'll say, you know, if you don't think of apples and oranges as different types of elements, but think of them as different types of axes in an n-dimensional space. There's an apple axis, there's an orange axis. then each bag becomes a vector in this space. Okay? And we can start talking about how similar vectors are as against how similar bags are. That's what we'll do next time. But before that, even there, we'll have to talk about normalizing the vectors. And you can always normalize the vectors by taking the unit vector in the direction of that vector. The way you do it is divide the quotient by the norm of the vector, which is, you know, number of oranges square plus number of apples square plus number of bananas square, the entire thing square root. The reason we do that normalization is basically this. The size better not matter. The distribution better matter. The size does not matter. So next time, we'll come back, basically do the vector similarity, which is very simple, and then talk a little bit about how to do relevance feedback and so on. Yeah.